For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everybody. Tigan, thank you for the opportunity. You know, the first thing I did when I opened this was like, oh, I hope I had the right notes in there. Because we have a board meeting today, too, so I have the minutes from the last one. And I was like, oh, wouldn't that be a great Dharma talk? But luckily, it's the right notes. I wanted to talk today about the three aspects or three characteristics, at least what the Buddha said they are, of our existence, of how we experience our lives and the phenomenon that make up our life. And you're all familiar with it, even if you're not sure what they are. First one is impermanence. The second one is suffering. And the third one is the concept of not-self or non-self or emptiness. The Buddha taught that if we engage with these three characteristics or three aspects in our daily life, constantly exploring them and investigating them, anything we need for awakening is there. So through the investigation of these three characteristics, each one of us has the potential to awaken. We get familiar with these characteristics with zazen, when we practice our zazen. But they're available to us. The investigation of them are available to us in every moment of our life, not only on the meditation cushion. First one, impermanence, in Pali, anicca, literally means the absence of continuity, meaning that everything we experience arises, changes, and then disappears. Oftentimes, as we go through our life, we have a feeling that this phenomenon happens very slow because we have a sense of continuity as being an individual human being, that we were born, we travel through our life, hopefully we get old and then we die. But somehow there seems to be the same person that travels through that life. Buddha's teachings tell us that that happening, changing, and disappearing, the more you look at it, can happen or does happen at a much rapid pace. Not only over a long span of a lifetime, but over a course of a year, over a course of a month, over a course of a week, over a course of a day, over a course of an hour, over a course of a minute, over a course of a second. So as we investigate this phenomenon more and more, we could magnify or fine-tune our investigation into what that impermanence really means. And it's always there at a smaller microcosmic level the more we investigate it. And it's always there at a larger macrocosmic level the more we investigate it. As human beings, we believe there is permanence somewhere based on the fact that we have an individual life that we travel through. For most people, that's our first idea of permanence. But there is a lot of assumption about our reality wrapped up in that. For example, we all know that kind of koan. If a tree falls in the forest and you're not there to witness it, did it really fall at all? So inherent in that type of koan is the idea that reality is happening even if we're not taking part in it. So we know right now we're sitting in this room and this is our momentary experience right here with each other. But yet if we just switch our mindset a little bit, we know that there are buses traveling down Irving Park Road. The L is still going to stop. There are people going about their business. There's a line at Starbucks ordering coffee. So is that real or not? It's an idea in my mind of what's happening around me. But if I'm not presently there experiencing it, is it real or not? So this is the kind of puzzle that Buddhist practice kind of offers us. when we practice, when we do zazen, because it says that that idea of the reality is just another sense. It's another way of experiencing reality. But is that what we're really engaging with in a momentary sense, in this second that we're living right now? Predictability, things being the same every day. The greatest predictability we all have as human beings is that the sun is going to rise every morning. I don't remember who first said that concept to me, but I want to say it was a Qigong teacher. But as human beings, we expect that sun to rise. But in reality, maybe it won't. We really don't know, but we're basing it on the fact that it keeps rising over and over again. If we take the long view over millennium, according to our scientists, it didn't always arise over the Earth's horizon because the solar system wasn't even there. So again, what is real? Does it depend on the amount of time that we put on it? Are things permanent based on the time we allot to it? Or are they always constantly changing, even though they give us a sense of predictability? We know simplistically, speaking of the journey that our lives take, that things change. We learn this at a very young age. But also, if we look around us, the way we experience the world, one of my favorite examples of impermanence and / continuity is the changing of the seasons. That there's plants and trees, flowers, and they bloom, come to fruition, and they die. And even though they die, they had a lifespan, but yet they're still there, and they bloom again. Okay. So does that mean there's an aspect of ourselves that is eternal? Or does that mean that things are constantly changing? But luckily, we have this great playground in which to investigate this phenomenon. According to the Buddha, the tree, just because the dead tree is there, doesn't mean that there is some kind of permanence in our existence. So that gives us a lot to think about. Even if there's a tree right in front of your house, you could spend a lifetime thinking and studying about the impermanence that the tree goes through. Food is another good example of impermanence, just that's accessible to us all the time. And I think about this more because I'm the acting Tenzo. But it comes in one form. In the kitchen, it goes through another. We ingest it goes through another form, and then we excrete it, and then it goes through another form again. So even in the process of keeping our bodies energized, there is a great amount of change that happens in that process that is always there for us to investigate closely to get a sense of the impermanence of our phenomenon and our experience. And then, of course, everything else like jobs and family relationships. Even if you have a nuclear family, the relationship you have to your parents changes throughout your lifetime, the relationship they have to you. So again, at times we have a sense of this stability, predictability, and permanence. But actually, if we really investigate it closer and closer and closer, we see that things are constantly in flux. So I'm going back and forth between a broad exploration and a very particular exploration. So I want to go back again to zazen. Because in reality, in our lives, we do have a broad and particular investigation of the way we're living our lives. Zazen, in our sitting meditation, helps us look at this impermanence in a very particular way. According to Buddhist teachings, we experience phenomenon through our eyes, nose, ears, mouth, tactile sensations, and mental formations. And you'll hear this concept very often in the chants that we chant. So this is the direct way that we experience things. When we're sitting in zazen, we could look very specifically at how each of those senses are taking in information. We don't have to look at all five of them at once, but we can even pick one. sound. And in each moment, really investigate how the sound changes in the room, how our perception of the sound changes throughout our meditation session. If we can look at phenomena like that in our zazen more particularly, then it's a little bit easier as we move out into the world to find that kind of specificity as well as we're moving throughout our life. Because at any given time, we could explore our experience in that kind of specificity, unless we have a specific task right in front of us that we're doing. But that is available through us to us throughout our day at any time. We also know then that mental formations are another way of investigating phenomena when we're sitting on our meditation cushion. And I don't know, but I think in our society, we tend to do that kind of investigation more because the way our culture is set up, we live in our heads. We're very much in a culture of ideas. But we can see, even with the investigation of ideas or mental formations, they come and go often without any kind of predictability, without any kind of impetus, without any kind of reason. So sitting in meditation, we become very familiar with this, arising, changing, and passing away over and over again. The more familiar we get with that on our meditation cushion, the easier it is to investigate our thoughts, ideas, emotions when we're moving throughout the world. But the only thing is we have to remember that that investigation is available to us. Oftentimes there's a dichotomy. When I'm sitting, this is when I'm investigating these things. When I walk out the door, I'm no longer doing that. I'm engaged with my life. But that reality is available to us all the time. We just have to bring our attention to it. A quote from the Buddha is, "Better it is to live one day seeing the rise and fall of things than to live 100 years without ever seeing the rise and fall of things." So getting a sense of the rise and fall of things in one moment is worth more than having 100 days of ignorance to that. And our awakening is inherent in that understanding and investigation. Suffering is a little easier. Suffering or unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, meaning suffering, pain, or sorrow. Nowadays, too, I think in our culture, in some ways, everything gets more polarized. So in some ways, suffering is polarized with unsatisfactoriness as well. Because we have certain elements of our society that really experience unsatisfactoriness at a constant level, and it seems to get magnified as compared to suffering. And I'm saying that because we almost don't want to use that word anymore, suffering, because people push back against it right away. They don't even like to think about what actual suffering might mean compared to unsatisfactoriness. But that's not why I'm bringing it up. We learn at a very young age that there are times we're in pain and anguish. I mean, that's almost a given because the minute, even as babies, when we're crying or have some kind of need, we experience it and we cry out for the people that are taking care of us. So in many ways, our life as we experience them, the suffering is inherent. So I put out the question, do most of you remember when you first realized that you are going to die? And I have vague recollections of it. And I remember the shock. That's how I remember it more. Not so much anguish, but the shock and disbelief that at some point I won't exist anymore. And I want to say it was around 4 or 5 years old. But even at that time, at such a young age, I felt that it was awful that I got that information. I'm like, why would someone tell me this? This is the worst thing. Okay, so if you really think about it, all of us went through that at some point in our lives. Maybe we remember it clearly, maybe we don't. But at some point, that realization was made aware to us. We had cognition of it. And for me, personally, that is one of the main things that brought me to Buddhist practice, because I think it's cruel. Like animals, we believe, don't really know they're going to die. Like they feel anxiety when they're being pursued, but they don't really know their existence is going to end. But we do. And I've always been like, God, why do we have to know this? Of course, as you mature, you realize that it defines your life, right? But it's kind of like mean. I like the word cruel because I really believe it's cruel that we know this. The second thing is knowing that we decay and die. Now, for any of us who are over 50, we're very aware of that. For as you're younger, it's an intellectual idea. And then we know from celebrity culture, like we could see our celebrities' age, like this is the cross they bear. Right? I mean, but it's not, it really isn't funny when you think about they're in the public light. We demand almost that they're beautiful, charismatic, and entertaining, but yet they have to age and someday die. So they're on this, like, I always picture all of them on this little treadmill, like a rat in a lab, and they're running, trying to figure out how to keep themselves looking youthful and charismatic and all this stuff. Of course, it seems American celebrities are more prone to that desperation, and European celebrities tend to take it with a grain of salt. But can you imagine having that kind of pressure on you to have to look fantastic all the time? Now, those of us who are over 50, like, it's more real for us. Like, can you imagine, like, having to take care of your crow's feet and gray hair and, you know, it's cruel. It's just... So that's the other thing. And then, of course, not being able to hold on to anything permanently, which now we're cycling back to impermanence, this kind of symbiotic relationship between these three characteristics. And I remember this at a young age, and I think 12 or 13, where it hit me that anything you could want in life, if you get it, you're going to lose it, no matter what it is. Whether it's a relationship, whether someone you love is going to die, whether it's a job, whether it's some kind of material thing that you get. So even if we're not, quote unquote, aware, these things are very obvious to all of us as human beings. Some of us look at it more closely, and some of us find ways to push it away. But we know in the long run we're going to face it. Even if it's on our deathbed, we're going to face it. We can't escape it. And in that, that's the great, great equalizer for all of us as human beings. So within that suffering is attraction, aversion, and indifference. Any phenomenon we experience, we either want it, and we go, oh, that would be great. But then we suffer if we think we can't get it. Okay? Or we really love some kind of experience and we have it, but then we suffer because we think we're going to lose it. And we know that we can't tread water and stay in it. We just know it. Okay? And then, of course, the ultimate indifference. We really don't care. We don't give a crap. And in some ways, there's a certain suffering as well, because every one of us at some point in our life woke up in bed and said, you know what? My life is in such a predicament right now that I can barely put one foot in front of the other because I don't care. I just don't care. And what's wrong with me? Why can't I care? Why don't I feel like I should be engaged more? So that's another form of suffering. And in some ways, it could be even worse than this push and pull of attraction and aversion when you feel there's no point, right? So investigating these three things and looking at it closer and closer and closer, the seeds of awakening are in there. And we can find that even though it's a characteristic of our experience, we need to move through it in some fashion. One exercise I like to do, because again, you know, we don't really think about physical pain that much anymore, because honestly, we live in a society where we're very comfortable. And again, I know this because I teach children, and the things that, like, for most of us, we've exercised our bodies, and even feeling muscular discomfort for them is pain. And they literally have to be told that it's not pain, it's discomfort. And discomfort is something you experience sometime as a human being. I'm saying the skillful means, and now you can hear sometimes there's still a little sarcasm in my voice. But again, we have to change. It's not their fault. They're new human beings, right? So they didn't like have some kind of sophisticated way of figuring out how not to have pain. They just know that they've never experienced physical discomfort in that fashion. Okay? But one thing I like to do to really explore suffering, for me personally, is anytime I have physical pain, we all know that physical pain is important for us because it's a telltale sign that something's wrong with our body. We know that. We can't avoid it because it really is something that nature gave us that's very good. If you broke your arm, you didn't have pain, you wouldn't know your arm was broken. And then a lot of physical bad things would happen from there, and I mean infection and all that, and you would lose your arm or you would die. Okay? But we know the minute we have any kind of physical pain, a headache, nausea, whatever, first thing we do is grab for something to stop it. And instead of doing that, sit with the idea, or don't do it right away, because let's be realistic, okay? But to sit with the idea that, okay, I'm experiencing pain, I want to push back against it, because this is easy for us to experience, because that's our go-to. I'm not going to push against it. I'm going to completely envelope it. I'm going to go through it. I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to say, okay, this is what my life is like right now. This pain is the way I should be experiencing life right now, and move through it completely and see how that feels. Okay, sometimes you can't do it. And I don't want to be flippant about it, and I don't want to make light of people's real pain when people are sick with illnesses or some kind of catastrophic thing. But it's a way to really see if we could change our idea of it, if we can completely immerse ourselves in it and maybe move through it. Okay, we could do this as well with psychological or emotional pain. But like for me personally, I'd rather have physical pain than emotional pain. I find it more difficult. So I would never say, yeah, just play around with that, because that could really have deep repercussions, especially because we live in our heads. But Zazen helps us on our meditation cushion feel physical discomfort sometime and allows us the opportunity to investigate it and move through it, and then it will also allow us to experience the things that might arise emotionally, psychologically. We want to not push that away if we can sit with it. Okay. We want to get familiar with what's going on. We want to get familiar with the constant changing emotional and psychological permutations as best as we can, and we want to investigate it further and deeper and more clearly. Zazen gives us the opportunity so that hopefully when we leave and go out into the world, we have a sense of what that feels like, and if we're having a hard time with something or someone or some idea, we could take a moment and start to investigate it a little more clearly, because it is available to us at any time. And then going to the last one, no self, anatta, which to me is the most difficult one to truly understand, is that there is no permanent self. When we experience things, we tend to have a sense of there is somebody watching the experience, or there's somebody kind of monitoring the experience. How do we completely immerse ourselves in the experience that there is no longer the watcher? I can't honestly say that I've ever experienced that. I don't know. I think, you know, I do martial arts, and any time I have this concept, the only time I could say I've experienced it is when I get punched in the face. And seriously, in that millisecond, there is no I. It's just the experience. And I want to say maybe went with sound sometimes, like for me, the clackers, because the clackers have more of a sharp sound to it, or the han. Sometimes when I hear the clackers, there is no sense of somebody else hearing it, where it just seems like that sound in me is one. But there's only, again, a millisecond where that happens. But according to the Buddha, it happens constantly and very quickly. So maybe it's okay if we experience it every now and then in a millisecond. Maybe it's not a place that we could actually sit in and stay there. Because if things are constantly changing, maybe that is the investigation of no self, that millisecond. We know at a broader level that we didn't happen in a vacuum, that two people had to come together for us to exist in this life. So we can investigate the phenomenon of what we supposedly are at any given moment. And we talk about this a lot in our Buddhist practice, in our Dharma talks, and our exploration of stories. But there is always a relational aspect to who we are in any given moment. Biologically, the eye can't function. If you take the eye apart, one aspect of the eye cannot see things. Okay, so there's the lens, the retina. Light has to go through the lens and hit the retina, and then that information has to go to the brain before you put all of those little things together to make a coherent image. So even our senses don't operate in a vacuum. Okay, so this, again, it's available to us at any time to investigate what this means and how completely things constantly work together. Sometimes it's hard for people to wrap their mind around the physical or social relational aspect of who we are in any given moment. So this, biologically, we can look at very easily when we think about it. So I feel these three characteristics are telling us to immerse ourselves as much as possible with direct sensation and experience, because reality is available to us all the time. Now we go back to the zazen and our meditation cushion. We have these six senses that are always operating. We could choose to look at any one of them at any given time, or we could choose to look at all of them at any given time as a point of concentration. If we decide we want to concentrate on something when we're sitting to help still the mind. But at some point, and this is what we teach in our Zen practice here, in our Soto Zen lineage, we want to relax into it. So once we get familiar with those points of concentration and looking more specifically at these three aspects, if we just relax ourselves and open ourselves up, this sense of reality is available to us all the time. So if we relax and open up, we will experience it. This is one of the things the Buddha promised. So it's a symbiotic relationship. And again, there's samadhi and vipassana, concentration and insight. These two things have a symbiotic relationship in our meditation practice. Through the exploration of these three characteristics, we're constantly going back and forth with these three and back and forth with those two so that the awakening happens for us, if not in this lifetime, maybe the next few. But I think at this point, I would like to open up the discussion to see if any of you remember any of these aspects of your life, or if you have any direct experience of any of these characteristics. Thank you.
So, questions, comments, responses, reflections, please feel free.
Or you could even vent on how mean and cruel life is. I don't mind. Oops. Now it's shut off. Thank you, Sid. Or at least try. I'm still trying to figure that out, too. That's one reason, though, too. Like, I've been looking at the Lankavatara Sutra, that's, like, mind only, and that's what I mean. Like, I couldn't even try to talk about that right now. I have no idea.
But just to add that our idea of self, our notion of self, our sense of self, as Paul was emphasizing, is also this physical experience. experience, which of course we have a consciousness of, but so what is consciousness?
Thank you, Phyllis. Yeah, unlimitless potential to be anything. Yeah, it takes us off of the goal-centric aspect of living our lives, you know, and where maybe our lives are about experiencing things instead of, like, having an endpoint and trying to get to that endpoint no matter what, you know?
It's a form of attachment, I guess, isn't it, to an idea?
Hey, thank you for a great talk. One of the things that helps me is thinking about just a larger concept of time. Time within my own life, but also as part of, you know, some of the changes that we would like to see in our world that we participate in, but I think we can feel very frustrated and hopeless when we don't get the kind of change that we expect and the time frame that we expect. And sometimes for me it helps to just step back and think about how, you know, I don't really know what the time frame for that change might be, but I can. And so if I'm, you know, trying to sort of give 110% to it and burn myself out, then maybe that's not an appropriate relationship to that process. Maybe it's more appropriate to think of it as participating in a marathon, you know, rather than a sprint race. That there are, and I find that helpful when I think about some of the things that can make us all feel really hopeless about what's happening in our world right now. That you know, we need to continue to participate, but maybe expand our expectations of the time frame.
I like that, because that's the only thing I say to anyone with confidence if they ask me, like, what did you learn in your life? With complete confidence that everything takes longer than you think it's going to. I mean, really, right?
This may be a whole other Dharma talk, so if in asking you what you might have to say about this, you can just say no.
I'm a yes person.
Okay, all right.
You know that.
All right.
Yes.
But isn't it the Parinibbana Sutra that says, sort of like you have heard it said that there is impermanence, suffering, and no self, but there is permanence, bliss, and self. Is that right? Am I correct?
Yeah. Oh, I knew someone would have to go there.
You can say no.
What do I want to say about that? I think that if we put, it's like putting the ox before the cart, or the cart before the ox, because you know the ox herd pictures, so I'm trying to be like kind of pithy with that, saying the horse before the, but anyway. I think that if we explore that too soon, it becomes a barrier to awakening. And I think as humans, we want to go there right away. Because that's what we want to be real. That there is a permanence. That Paula is going to exist in some fashion after, and maybe not physically, but some idea of what I was or everything I learned somehow is going to have my little imprint on it. And I do believe in rebirth, personally. So, like, it's going to have an imprint in that next life, even though I'm not going to be Paula anymore. So I think that if we go to that concept too soon, I understand it's there. If we don't have the wisdom to explore it, it's a distraction and a trap to bring us back into duality.
So, just to add to what Paula said, I did talk about the Parinibbana Sutra and the teaching of self, bliss, permanence in that sutra last year in Rohatsu Sesshin, a year ago. And what Paula just said is exactly what the sutra says about it, that we need to immerse ourselves in, from the perspective of self, bliss, permanence, that is the Dharmakaya, that is the ultimate truth from the widest possible time frame. But people see those in false ways. We think of self in terms of our personal self. We think of permanence without seeing how things are always constantly changing. We see bliss as ignoring the pain and suffering of reality. So it's not a contradictory teaching in a way. And as Paula said, we have to see the ways in which our usual ideas of self, our usual idea of permanence, a usual idea of what would be bliss is false. So, we start with what Paula was talking about today. And then to have a sense that, you know, from the ultimate perspective, you know, we could talk about Joe Rakugajo, about these, that Dharmakaya perspective, maybe is an encouragement, but we have to start with life on our cushions, life on the ground. Thank you very much, Paula.